Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU Libraries, and on behalf of the libraries, I'd like to thank all of you for coming out tonight for another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. We're delighted that you're here. Our guest reader tonight is Allison Swan. Allison Swan's poems have appeared in many publications, including the Bellingham Review, the Red Cedar Review, and the Detroit Metro Times. Her poem, Porch Swing, published as a limited edition handmade book, is included in rare book collections throughout the country, including the New York Public Library, the University of Michigan, and Michigan State University. Swan's creative nonfiction, Tracing the Winter Dunes, set in the Lake Michigan sand dunes in deep winter, was included in MSU Press's 2000 anthology, Peninsula, Essays and Memoirs from Michigan. In 1991, Swan received her MFA in creative writing from the University of Michigan, and in 1984, she graduated from MSU with a BA in English literature. She taught literature and writing at both the secondary and higher levels for more than 6 years. Swan has written a book column for Ann Arbor's Current magazine since 1996, and her book reviews have appeared in Fourth Genre and The Paper. From 1993 to 1997, she managed publicity and advertising at Shaman Drum Bookshop in Ann Arbor. Presently, she is editing an anthology of women's creative nonfiction about the Great Lakes and writing a collection of essays about Michigan's Upper Peninsula. She also co-owns a bookstore in Saugatuck called Blue Rhino Books and Other Necessities and co-chairs Concerned Citizens for Saugatuck Dunes State Park, an organization dedicated to the preservation and expansion of Lower Michigan's only rustic freshwater sand dunes state park. Please join me in welcoming Allison Swan for tonight's meeting.
Thank you, Peter. I'm a little stumped as to whether I should stand behind the huge table and be able to set my papers down or come around it and hold them. I think I'm opting for not having the table in between us. But I'm going to probably have a little awkwardness with the papers because of that. So please forgive me. For the last few years, I've been absorbed in seeing our daughter safely and happily to the age of 3. And I am very grateful to Peter Berg for inviting me to come here and read at this particular point in time, because the banks of the Red Cedar River are the perfect place to dip my toes back into the waters of reading my work aloud to people and talking about it aloud with people. It's been a few years since I've done that. As I told Stephanie Mattson, who has been my very helpful contact person, thank you, Stephanie, I've spent hours and hours and hours in this building, reading literature and history and a little economics and some philosophy and writing my poems and thinking about my writing life. And in a very real way, my life as a serious thinker and writer started in this town on this campus. And I owe a huge debt to Diane Wachowski. And also to this town and to this campus, which was a very nurturing place to land as an unsophisticated suburban girl with literary aspirations. That was 22 years ago, which feels good to say that somehow. The last couple of decades seem like some kind of accomplishment for some reason. I'm going to begin with poems, and I'm going to also read an excerpt from A Work in Progress, which happens to be creative nonfiction. I'm going to start with poems from my unpublished poetry manuscript called Let the Branch Break. And I'll begin with the title poem. When I was a student in the MFA program at U of M, my fellow student, Mark Webster, who was not quite 30, died of a massive heart attack in the middle of the night, which was due to a congenital heart defect he didn't know he had. And his wife was pregnant with their first child. And that was quite some time ago, and it's still hard to read this poem, but I want to begin with it anyway because it's an important poem. Let the branch break. March. The trees are dead. I am not alone in fearing this. Last October, the leaves were brilliant, as if lit from within. My friend, almost a father, died in the arms of the woman who would bear their daughter into the same sturdy embrace. Let the branch break and fall. Snagged or not, it will crumble into the air or earth, So familiar, we say, mundane. Here's why it's not. Sap will creep, bark will surrender its cache, life will prod the living. Right around the same time, I read a book called The Late Great Lakes by William Ashworth, which is an environmental history of the Great Lakes, and cried for about 15 minutes after I finished it. This poem was triggered in part by that book and in part by walking along the beach on Lake Michigan and noticing little clumps of twig bits and sand that seemed to be moving towards the water. And when I bent closer to look at them, they were little little worm-like insects that were encrusted with twigs and other debris to protect them from being eaten. And they were making their way to the lake where they would finish their life cycle. They were caddisfly larvae. After reading The Late Great Lakes, the dead gave their last blood to birds. Cardinals, red-winged blackbirds, and the downy woodpecker, red-capped, persistent, extracting food from bark in small portions with every season. White tails browse fairways, medians, and kitchen gardens. More real estate parceled, so a golf course gets 9 new holes. The sun appearing to set is a gorgeous ruse. We see it and we don't. Like spring's caddis worms, gritty and countless, creeping to the Great Lakes edge where fish rise from the bottom and feed. A house in the country. Starlings, hundreds flew, filling the cavern below the trees before disappearing onto branches. All the weight of spun sugar, you're thinking. Well, they disturbed enough molecules to jostle me, half conscious in a lawn chair, doing a crossword. Listen, this is no exurban pastoral. The husband next door shot his wife in the head. Gossips blame her, nagging. But think of his gun and trigger finger, gray wisped sweat on her cheeks, and those starlings, so many, so light, then gone. I think probably almost everyone in here remembers when Amoco's were standards. And one day I got gas at a station that still had a standard sign, and I just loved that. And I also loved the fact that it was still a service station. It wasn't operating as a service station, but it still had the garage doors, and you went in to pay for your gas. You couldn't pay at the pump, and this wasn't that long ago. Self-serve. I'm pumping self-serve under a sign that still reads standard across the street from an old factory almost entirely in ruins as of today. The rubble clinks with backhoes and wears a single peeling wall on which has been spray-painted, "Christ has risen for peace and love," and then in the same hand, "And Jimi Hendrix, too." Jimmy is misspelled. The misspelling hits me like a reproach, and I envy the finger releasing the paint in the middle of a night that still vibrates with crickets. Under my own hand, the gas stops flowing. I replace the nozzle in the pump, the cap on the tank, and cross the lot with keys in one hand, cash in the other. The kid inside at the counter, in a room that no longer opens into a service garage, tells me he thinks a mall's going up. Just what we need, I say, another mall, though I am most definitely not we, having driven 2.5 hours to spend my day off in this small coastal town people like me are seeing to the remaking of. And then I'm considering that this cashier and his neighbors just might like a place to pick up fragrance samples or some other packet of glamour after a week of making change and separating credit card receipts. Though if his thoughts are running this way, I can't know, since he's expressionless in the way that makes me try to hold my tongue more and buy gas from automated pumps. I look forward to the day when this next poem is no longer timely. It's very hard for me to give a public reading without at least a passing reference to the war that seems to be impending and seeming almost impossible to avoid. September 1995. Last night, our house settled deep into swells burnished by moonlight. our sleep was the sleep of mollusks. I'm walking sidewalks marked with years, handprints, and animal tracks. The concrete ages like coral torn from its element and bleached, chalk white to mildewed to crumble. A red day lily blossom floats in grassy leaves browning toward winter. Cultivated roses curl back into ripening. 1/2 mile below the floor of the South Pacific, France detonated an atomic bomb. The water foamed for hours. I am not generally a lighthearted person, and the presence of children in my life is crucial and miraculous and glorious. And this poem is written for one of my little friends named Nicholas, who was 3 when the incident happened that inspired this poem. It was in the city in Chicago where he lived. For Nicholas, who hummed soap bubbles on West Roscoe. You hummed. The north wind, invisible as your humming, stole around your baby cheeks and found the wand, inflated shimmering globes and hollow pearls, sent them up and away, spit shone on your red mouth, open and laughing. Your eyes glittered with new knowledge, the magic of on, off, the whole inside of a room retrieved from darkness. Raindrops swept from the windshield. You dipped, then raised the red plastic wand to your lips, hummed and hummed. Squirrels and birds gathered. A gust grabbed the trees, clattered the bare bushes, tickled your little boy's scalp, and sprayed your mom and me with suds and spit. We ducked and laughed. The air around us sparkled with bubbles. Even the painter on the 3rd floor cracked open his door and called, Nicholas, you are the king of bubble blowers. That such a shimmering of the world should start with the hum in your chest. I wrote this poem here in Lansing 21 years ago, I think. And it's one of the first poems that I had published. The Red Cedar Review published it. So it's a young poem and it's an old poem, but I wanted to read it because of those things. She is 12. Saturday stretches before her, a smooth black-topped road through spruce and fir. She climbs down the blue spruce outside her window into forest of evergreens where red Indian paintbrush and blue harebells merge to purple that becomes night. She lies down then and listens to wind surf through needles and the bugling of bull elks. I had a professor at the University of Michigan ask me what a merman was. And so I just want to mention that that word will crop up. And it's, of course, the male version of a mermaid. Mermaid. She tells him to kiss her toes till his spit's dried up and his lips and tongue are numb. They already are anyway, she cries into his ear. He flinches. She nips her teeth like the edges of shells against his ears. She even has the sound of waves in her mouth. Her fingers are strong. He bends them, his hand making her hand hold his. Then she laughs and bites his nose, calling him siren hater. He has to agree, having no idea what she really means. Her joking turns to mermen, mostly useful for their mouths, and he rushes his hands to his crotch in a flat scallop, feeling a tail sweeping plankton through water, and she's still laughing. Her eyes begin to tear. The salt, the water, the confounding irascibility of this woman flapping in his arms. What we never considered. 1. I hurl a litany of yes across the scrub of Michigan, southern heel of the palm where things grow small. These rain-streaked oaks have become exceptions. I wonder who carefully built around them 100 years ago. My voice flies out, borne on the backs of starlings flocking from empty corn stalks to fruit orchards. I plant myself next to you on the acorn-cobbled bluff to watch water pulse under wind and over gravity, tide, white caps. You must take my earnest flung answers into account when you come dragging contracts, business, and personal behind you. I am the black feathered creature from your dream, glossy, quick, small. From you, I invite anything. Let me abandon propriety to your clutch, settle in the rays, crush weeds beneath me, and take seeds to tongue. Two. This white, leached bluff is high temptation. Your voice froths in my ears, even in the air. The waves unfurl truce. Behind us shelves sanity. I find open sky, open sea in your hands, these sonorous trees, and the reach of your voice. Never, never eat Pringles on your way to read. This poem is from another young friend named Sam, and it's not a light poem. A true story. He is standing shin deep in snow. He has been walking for hours. It is 16 degrees. The sky is empty. A half mile off, a herd of elk move on the land like liquid. He wants to be closer. He sits down in the snow. He is not cold. The elk move toward him. He stays still till he hears hooves and snorts, sees the steam of their breaths. Without standing, this landscape is treeless, and he is tall. He tucks the gun to his shoulder. Sighting requires skill, pulling the trigger, conviction. The walk down to the elk's body can be measured in yards. It feels endless. The rifle hangs from his shoulder, cooling. The ears are larger than he imagined, furred. The black nose so nearly living, he flinches. The steel blade gives an edge to his arm, bloodied to the shoulder. He must field dress the carcass or risk spoiled meat. As a boy, he fished the green rivers of Michigan. So much green, even the air hummed. Now his father lives in the city on the streets where his mother died of exposure. These dry hills release their own river of beating hearts. It takes hours to get the meat home to his family. Two round trips by snowmobile, then a long ride by pickup. That poem started out, I wanted to mention that when I first began writing that poem about a true story that was related to me, I was feeling very judgmental towards the hunter, and by the time I had finished writing the poem, I felt only warmth for him. And to me, that is the biggest gift that one gets from writing, and hopefully from reading, too. I always have to read a couple rants. They're fun to write, they're fun to read. I'm not sure they're as fun to listen to, but I hope that it's somewhat enjoyable. These times call for rants anyway. I don't take what I need. Out of the earth, fingers. No other hands will do. Green and green and green, I want what we don't have. Chlorophyll, pollen, roots. A jet changes my place, transfers nearly immediate. I'm buckled in, utterly helpless, too much to rely on a stranger. I have more faith in horses and dogs. Creature of the land, I crave shores, beaches, bluffs, rocky crags. There is no breakwater on that list. We're safer in salt water than on city streets. It's a statistic. And anyway, sometimes I'm sure I'd rather feed a shark than this economy. Plastic, flush toilets, bed springs, a knee-jerk litany we learn. Don't call yourself free if you're loyal to a soft drink or anything else that's marketed. The barter system is un-American, which explains a lot. Pesticides feed, but they don't nourish. We don't take what we need, we take what we can. If I'm romantic at all, and I think I am, I'm actually quite a nature freak, I do believe that in nature lies the salvation of the world. I said it. I do think that. And this poem is this is my small proposal for making some leeway in that direction. Proposal for a National Forest Service brochure. Park and undress in the empty parking lot at a trailhead. Any mountain trail will do. Let the sun pour down your back. Turn and close your eyes. Watch it pour orange. Dress for the trail. Pack food, water, and leave your human noises in the car. Climb till your heart, lungs, and limbs braid into the rope that pulls you on. Trees anchor switchbacks. Give them your hand a few times and brush gently against plants and shrubs. Disturb no rocks. And when you return to the car, because of course you must, be glad for the seeds which, having hitched rides, will drop healthy in your wake. The last poem I'm going to read is the poem that brought me here. It's the poem that was in the limited edition handmade book that Peter acquired for the library here at MSU. And the artist who made me write the poem, really, because she gave me the photographs and said, here, do you think you can do something with these? And lo and behold, luckily, I came up with a poem that she could use to make the book, is here, Jean Buescher. And I'm really happy to see her because it's been a long time. Porch Swing, after photographs by Jean Buescher. Oh, I have to tell you one thing about the broadsides. Jean wanted the ink to be green. She was trying to mix green ink. Am I remembering that right? I think she was trying to mix a certain color anyway to do the printing, and she couldn't get it to be the color she wanted it. It insisted on being blue. Porch Swing. There is a bit of blue in everything, even shadows enfolding these scraps, twigs, planks, and spindles. It is all wood, and it was all sky once. At the side of the road that ends here, someone has tried to stop a tree, lopped the branches back to the first fork. New shoots, resilient as grass, pull against the same gravity that battens sky among us. Everything gives back light. Oh, I have to read a few more poems. These are the poems I call the diary poems because they were all inspired by the actual diaries and letters of 19th century Michigan women. I actually got to hold their diaries and their letters in my hands and read them. I spent dozens of hours with them at the Bentley Historical Library in Ann Arbor. And it was an extraordinary experience because all of their voices started talking in my head. And I have to be fair to them and say that I have definitely left my personality in these poems. But they were inspired by the words of real women, not myself. The first poem is a miracle poem, I think, because I found the girl who was 14's diary filed in a file box in a series of manila folders, all of which had the years on the tab of her father's journals. And something made me go through the box folder by folder because there was no female name on the file card or the box. And halfway through the folders, I came upon a diary that was completely different from the rest, and I looked at it more closely, and it was a diary of this 14-year-old girl named Isa H. Parker. And I'm gathering her father saved it. Her father probably thought that she was a good writer, and I agree, and saved her diary in with his own. It's just unfortunate that her name didn't make it to the catalog card. The diary was kept between 1869 and 1871, and when I go like this, before the next pause, everything will be in parentheses, and everything that's in parentheses is her exact words. And I want you to know that those are her exact words because you'll be able to see what an extraordinary writer she was. In Victorian times, the marriage, becoming a woman, getting married, was called the dark leap. This poem is called The Dark Leap. It's still a girl. I wonder if others who appear so sensible are as foolish as I. Mother sugared off this forenoon and sent me with maple sugar to the neighbors. I rode too muddy for the sleigh. I walked. I met a silly-looking man with his hands in his pockets and a sunburned face. He asked me question upon question, beginning easily enough. Does your father want to hire a man? But then, I suppose you are not married. I am 14, and it is the kind of weather that always makes me feel as if I should like to go and lie down in the sun. The new grass is so green and soft and young. No, sir, not I. I suppose you would if you got a chance to. I started off. Whosoever lives on that farm there, are they looking for a hired man? I kept going. Where does this road lead to? Oh, give me a horse to roam through the prairie grasses of the west, where there are no men or folks. Let me taste something of the world. I have got to deliver this sugar, sir. This woman's name is lost, except for her first, Ella. She was writing letters to a man named Frank Harlow in Marquette in the late 1800s, 1874, 1875. The Harlow family was a very prominent family in Marquette in the 19th century, Marquette, Michigan. Dear Frank, I led the way. The sky is overcast with fishback clouds, always a sure precursor of a storm, I think I have told you. We took a ride to Sylvanport and Father's Mill today. When we stopped for supper, my horse broke the strap to the wagon. I remounted so as to teach the naughty creature a lesson. As for me, I get such a shaking and rubbing down right and left. Dr. Trine says his Swedish movement cure will make me look better and behave better and feel better. There is a feeling in my bones as though you would be in Marquette about the last of next week. What do you think of my feelings or of my bones? By the way, coming home, I led the way. And Mr. A did not drive fast enough to keep up. I would walk every 10 or 15 minutes so he might overtake us. I did not tell him so. My horse and I are well suited, I think. It is all in fun, Frank. This is a found poem. Every word is lifted right out of a journal kept in the 1830s, a mother recording some pretty cool moments she was having with her four-year-old. And I used to think it was strange that she tied him to the table leg until I have a three-year-old. And I think about the fact that they were on the prairie in the 1830s. Cyrus knows. Cyrus disobeyed. I tied him to the table leg. He was anyhow but contented and at last exclaimed, I don't want to be tied. I think Indians tie dogs. When I went to the chief's lodge, I think I saw his dog tied. A while since, I kissed him and washed his face. He asked why I do so, saying, dog's kiss. Today, he stood at the door, hallooing a while, and then came in, wished to know what it was he heard in the mountain. We did not know at first, but he added, Cyrus knows. We and the trees and everything have a shadow, and it is like that, I think. My voice has a shadow. If we'd had a president named Cyrus, I would say it must have been that little boy. Okay, I'm going to switch gears now and read an excerpt from a work in progress called Stealing the Kettle. Onyx Smith says, we call places sacred because they hold our essential stories. And this is about a place that holds my essential stories, some of my essential stories. Before I start, I'd just like to note that my family has been in the Upper Peninsula since the mid to late 1800s, and in the small, small, small town of Big Bay since around the turn of the century. Stealing the Kettle. I also have to mention that my mom and dad drove all the way from Detroit to be here, which means so much to me. And I'm very grateful to them for taking me to this place every single summer for 2 weeks growing up. That was quite a gift. The idea to break into the cinderblock cottage and steal the kettle from the top of the stove was born over pints of fresh beer on a gray January evening in the warehouse district of Kalamazoo, Michigan. My husband David and I leaned conspiratorially toward one another as he described his plan. It was my 36th birthday, and I was being talked into smashing the windows of somebody else's summer place. The pub was dark and cheerful, smokers huddled out back in the chilly garden, so the air inside was redolent of hops, barley, and malt. Next to us, a huge aquarium full of freshwater fish glowed blue-green. I was appreciating the nod to locality when someone poured in a plastic bag of minnows. We watched the tiny silver fish dart or hang among the stones and weeds. Many were eaten within minutes. When the last one managed to evade capture for several long moments, I silently rooted for her. I am not a lighthearted person. When she was gobbled up, my stomach lurched. So I'm really going to do it. We're not just going to talk about it. I'm going to go up there and get that kettle. I said as much to myself as to David, and whatever else you want, and whatever else I want. Half a dozen Great Lakes fish digested their meal behind glass. Outside, icy winter rain pounded the snow clover to slush, and I thought about the little cabin in the woods 500 miles away near the frozen Lake Superior shore. 50 years ago, my grandfather converted the garage of an old hunting camp into a three-room cabin in the woods. Its sleeping loft's windows look out now as they have since then, at Lake Independence and the dark green Huron Mountains rising up behind it. Its dirt two-track driveway leads to the narrow blacktop road, which skirts a cedar swamp and leads, depending upon which fork one follows, to the tiny town of Big Bay and then on to Marquette, or to the sweeping bay for which that town is named, home to one of the few harbors along the rugged southern shore of the world's largest body of fresh water. Big Bay, a logging company town founded around 1900, has never really prospered. It's too cold or buggy or remote, depending upon which local you ask and what their most recent challenge has been. Everyone there complains about the weather, the mosquitoes, the isolation, but no one who sticks around really doubts that those three things keep the town exactly how they want it, peaceful and plain. By the 1970s, when I was a schoolgirl spending summer vacations in my grandparents' cabin, Big Bay had a few paved roads, but was absent from state road maps. "We go here," I'd tell curious friends from my downstate home, pointing at an irregular blue quadrangle, the large inland lake that on the map looked to be a stone's throw from Superior at the literal end of the road. Big Bay's population has hovered right around 250 for all of my life and was probably never much greater. Like so many small towns, Big Bay has had its share of brushes with fame. Henry Ford, having grown fond of the rustic but genteel Huron Mountain Club, built a lumber mill in Big Bay in the 1940s. The mill was superfluous to Ford Motor Company's operations and closed almost immediately. That's where they milled the side panels for the First Country Squires. They used to be real wood, my parents would tell my brothers and me as we rolled along the town's main drag in our 1970 model, sporting fake wood siding. We'd look down the grassy hill at the red brick warehouse looming from clear-cut meadows on the Lake Independence shore. To this day, the smokestack, also red brick, rises 20 or more stories. We never tired of the story that always came next. "I climbed it as a girl," my mother would tell my brothers and me. And we'd look with doubt at the iron ladder bolted to the length of it, and then at one another. Could we? "Oh, I'm sure it's much too deteriorated by now. That was a long time ago." A mile or so further down the shore, the little cinder block cottage was waiting, as it seemed it always would, behind the sandy bluff, forested with second growth trees. A mosaic of moss and dropped acorns covered the short slope that led down to the wooden screen door of the cabin we called the little cottage, to distinguish it from the white one on the bluff, which was actually smaller. In the same familiar way, we called Lake Independence the Little Lake, which was far from little, to distinguish it from Lake Superior. Dinner would be waiting, perhaps dump cake and burger bundles, and the kettle full of water pumped from the well and warmed on the old gas stove to wash the dishes. The sound of that hand pump rattling and of the large old aluminum kettle clunking against the iron burner grate punctuated some of the happiest moments of my childhood, dressing in one of the cold bedrooms for another day roaming the woods, helping Grandma prepare lunch, playing Scrabble at the big oak table. As a girl rolling past the mill at the start of another summer vacation, I would be thinking of all those things. As well as of the firm hugs we'd be wrapped in shortly by Grandpa and Grandma. When they were in their 80s and I just past 30, they unceremoniously sold camp, as all summer cottages are called in the North Woods. 300 lakefront feet, two rustic cabins with all furnishings, including, unbelievably, the kettle, despite the pleas of more than one of us to hold it back. Two well-tended outhouses, one wooden footbridge, a dock, two skiffs, a meticulously maintained, though oft-repaired, ski boat and boat hoist, and a small piece of at least 10 people's souls went to strangers from Tennessee with the right offer. What's wrong with their woods? I'd muttered to myself. They intend to pass it down to their boys, my grandmother had reported to me brightly with apparent oblivion that took my breath away. How nice for them, I'd snarled. What? How nice for them. And even as I was looking into the hazel eyes that have so often gazed lovingly at me from a face now aged and tired, I couldn't bring myself to tone it down the second time. If my angry hurt registered with my grandma, she didn't respond to it. And that is the steely side of her. Among her four daughters and 14 other grandchildren, she is mostly described as intense, and the word is not intended as a compliment. When she, we have all been given to understand that it was she and not they who decided to sell our paradise to the highest bidder, I found myself participating in the bad-mouthing of her for the first time in my life. That anger fueled me somewhat as I packed the car for the trip north to retrieve the kettle. Spring was a couple months old, the morning hazy and still. I tried to think like a thief, choosing our least conspicuous car and loading it with what I imagined to be breaking and entering supplies. Flashlight, screwdrivers, Phillips and flathead. Mallet, wrench, crowbar, tote bags, stepladder, hand drill. Camps all around the lake are deserted in May, and I expected that Tennesseans especially wouldn't leave their flowering trees for mosquito season. I could be as loud and slow as I wanted. I packed frivolous supplies as well, a spade, plastic pails. I planned to transport plants for our garden, even packing paper for breakables, the idea of which did make me smile, and my camera. The whole process would have been hilarious if it wasn't so sad. You don't want to own them, Allison, my grandmother had told me on the phone the week she and my grandfather listed with a realtor. They need so much work. You have no idea. And again, I had muttered to myself, no, you are the one who's clueless. You don't have to rake every day, sweep after every meal. Hell, you don't even have to clean weekly when you're living in the woods. But it was no more my nature to speak my mind to my particular grandmother than it was hers to live anywhere that wasn't immaculate. As I packed the last items into our car before heading north for the kettle and whatever else, the chirr of a red-bellied woodpecker sounded from among the massive oaks and maples on our street. The sound recalls to me the same feeling of space I have among the mangroves of South Florida, where I first connected the song with its singer and where we have also lived. I have done a lot of moving, 7 homes as a child, a different address for each year of college, 8 more in 16 years of marriage. My grandparents' cottages near Big Bay were the only constant shelter I'd known. Every other roof has been temporary. I drove through Big Bay at dinner time, headed right out to camp past the old mill and ditches full of brilliant yellow marsh marigolds and parked in the neighbor's driveway. Their cabin was still closed up for the winter. I opened the car door to a roaring south wind, sweeping all the relatives downstate into my mind even as I tried to put them out of it. None of them would approve of my errand, but I was actually quite alone. I began at the kitchen door, locked. Under my feet was the worn rag rug I'd watched my grandmother shake 100 times. Hunched in the blasting wind, I pressed my forehead against the window, took deep breaths, and tried to subdue adrenaline jitters. The kettle, large as a small bucket and bearing the same sort of wire and wood handle, was exactly where I'd expected it to be, directly across from the door on the old white stove, back left burner. My eyes wandered over to the old iron hand pump with its faded red paint, silent now at the edge of the white ceramic sink, and then up to the windowsill above it where the copper kitchen timer was exactly where my grandmother had left it. I could see her, vigorously pumping, 1, 2, 3 heaves to fill the kettle for dishes, or my father shaving, or my mother shampooing. As for us children, we lived warm water free, bathing in the lake, washing for dinner with a splash of cold water and Dove soap. But it wasn't until I encountered my grandfather's gray canvas working gloves as they rested on top of his worn wicker kindling basket, left stocked for the new owners, that I was almost knocked to my knees by grief. I mourn the loss of our cabins on Lake Independence because they hold so many essential stories I'm afraid I'll forget. I'm not going to continue reading, but I will tell you that I did not break into the cabin. But it was a long process, and when the essay is finished and published, you can read it and find out what happened. I would be more than willing to answer any questions you have. It's It's been a pleasure to read to you. It can be something as you can ask me something about the content or something about my writing process. I was hoping that it would end up being longer than it was. I ended up writing about 10 poems. Each poem amounted to about 35 hours of reading. So it was wonderful, but that was as much reading as I was interested in doing at the time. I think it's something I'll do again because it was extraordinary.
Did you read the diaries with the purpose of writing the poems, or did you
Yes.
just...
Although I didn't know what kind of poems they would be, I didn't really have a plan for the kind of poems that would arise out of the experience. I just knew that if I spent hours reading the exact words in the exact handwriting on the exact pages, that something would come out of that. I just believe that there'd be even like a mystical thing that would be possible because of having that actual contact with the books. Oh, I'm editing a collection of creative nonfiction by women about the Great Lakes. And what I did is I've been soliciting creative nonfiction from established writers of poetry and fiction in hopes of generating a body of work that doesn't exist, and I think should. There are many talented writers in the Great Lakes Basin. And for whatever reason, there is no book collecting narratives, true narratives, by contemporary writers who are literary. And so far it's been fantastic. And I'm talking to a few different publishers, and I'm quite sure that knock on wood, cross my fingers, but I'm quite sure that the book will appear in the next year or two.
Why only women?
I've done so much reading in the works of women, and a lot of the reading that I've done expresses a certain relationship to the natural world and to place. And I was hoping by collecting only the work of women, I would help nudge the book towards some linking themes. It's a bit of a stretch. It did happen that way though. There is a lot more talk of family and spirituality and I would say what I would call kind of personal suffering in relationship to the lakes than I have read in the work of the men nature writers or men writers on place that I've read. It also was an easy way to limit the number of submissions I would get, and I have to be honest and say that was part of my motivation. I also wanted to meet some cool women who I didn't know who were writing about the Great Lakes, and I have. So.
How many women will be in the anthology?
I think about 30, and I've devised this little plan to include many more voices than I would otherwise have been able to by pulling out quotes from works that I don't include in whole, and putting them in the margins so that there will... This also answers Diane's question. There's this spectacular hardcover coffee table book done on the Colorado River in which she was a producer, really, who did the book. She does videography. But she asked established women writers to take the trip down the river and then write about it. And she juxtaposed the pieces they wrote with excerpts from the diaries of the female river guides. And so it made this great dialogue back and forth on the page. So that's what I hope to do. Because I'm getting some work from people that just, you know, there are pieces, parts of it that are just beautiful. The whatever is being expressed is beautiful and I don't want it lost, but the whole piece wouldn't work. So that's my plan.
So you're doing the editing, are you also doing the layout? It sounds like you have this whole visual image of how the pieces are fitting together on the page. Are you doing that too?
No. And I'm hoping that that's not too difficult to, and I don't even think that it would matter a lot where the, where they were. They would just go with certain essays. Thank you so very much for coming.